Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Mike Lewis here, of course. I just finished reading one of the better books I've read on leadership. It's a president of University of Richmond. He also was the former head of the music school at the University of Texas. A stupendously interesting book about race and leadership. And I managed to get him on the phone. The author of the book is Dr. Ronald Crutcher. And his book is titled, I Had No Idea You Were Black. Now, if the audio sounds a little bit different, I had to get him earlier on Skype because we were having some technical difficulties in meeting up. But take a listen to what he had to say about how he got the title to his book and what this book is about, because I think that it is absolutely worth a read. And again, the book is titled, I Had No Idea You Were Black by Dr. Ronald Crutcher.
Dr. Crutcher, the book title is obviously pretty compelling immediately, and you have an anecdote in the book about that. Can you tell our listeners like where the title of the book came from, what story it came from?
Surely, absolutely, and it's pleased to be with you, Mike. Well, you know, initially that was not going to be the title of the book, but when my editor heard about the story, she thought it would really be quite compelling and provocative in these times. And so the story goes into the following. I mean, in 1997, I had been at the University of Texas at Austin as the first director of the Butler School of Music for a couple of years, 3 years. I've been trying to get an appointment to meet with a man who was the chair of a foundation that gave scholarships to support violin study, only violin. I didn't do other string instruments. So I finally got in the appointment, walked into his office. He was an oil executive. He shook my hand, and literally as I was lowering myself to my seat, he looked at me and he said, I had no idea you were black. And I'm thinking, okay, let's see where this goes. And rather than responding, I did what my father had taught me growing up. You know, that is, when somebody says something to you that kind of knocks you off your feet, don't respond viscerally. Take a breath, you know, and then respond. So I took a breath, and before I could say anything, and quite frankly, I don't know what I would have said at the time, he said to me, perhaps you can help me. My wife and I have been going to the Aspen Music Festival for 30 years, and we rarely see any black violinists. Why is that? And so I launched into this really great discussion with him about why that was, about what we were doing at the University of Texas at Austin. And it just so happened that a black violinist who had been a student at the Cleveland Institute of Music, where I was the dean before I went to Texas, had come to the University of Texas, not necessarily because I was there. Her parents relocated back home to Texas. She didn't know what she was going to do. So they said, why don't you go to UT Austin? Dr. Crutcher's there, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so I was able to get some money to support her. And in fact, she today is a member of the Cleveland Orchestra. She's switched to viola. And I use that story with my mentees as a cautionary tale in the sense that, you know, you can never be certain of someone's intent when they say something.
Right.
And so when I asked them, okay, you know, what would you have done? You know, obviously it's obvious what one can infer the intent might have been. Is there another way he could have broached the subject with me? And we have a really good conversation about it.
Just curious, I assume is still around? Is he aware that he is the anecdote in your book?
To be honest with you, Mike, I have no idea if he's still around. So that was 1997. At the time, you know, at my age, young age, at the time I was 50, he seemed much older. Who knows? I mean, you know, I'm 73 now, so he could have been just a few years older than I. But you know, I have a way. I'm actually going to go back. The man who was my chief fundraiser at the School of Music, I'm still close with, and I'm going to see. It would be interesting to find out if he's still alive and to contact him.
So when you what coalesced the idea to write this particular book. By the way, it's terrific. I was, you know, normally when you're doing an interview like this, you try and get as much information as you can. Sometimes you don't have time to read a book. I started reading it and I didn't want to put it down. It was terrific. Wow. What was the genesis to take these ideas, a lifetime of ideas, and put them into this particular book?
I'd say it was 2006 when I was asked to be a speaker at the Association of American Colleges and Universities annual meeting. Every year they do a luncheon for faculty and staff of color with a keynote speaker. I was asked to be the speaker, and I did a speech that year called Spiraling Through the Glass Ceiling, Seven Lessons that you Need to Be Aware of, or something like that, for aspiring leaders. And after I'd written it, and they asked me to publish it, And for years after that, I would share it with people I was mentoring. And so in 2013, as I was about to complete my 10 years as president at Wheaton College and to go on my first sabbatical ever, I thought, you know, maybe I should write a book, you know, use that. Because by that time, I had not only written that article, but a couple of other articles that included autobiographical information. And people had responded very positively to them. So I thought, you know, it'd be great to begin writing a book. I did that. At the time, it was an autobiographical memoir. When we got to Germany in 2014, I decided that because it was my first sabbatical ever, that rather than spending my time working on the book, I told my wife, you know, we may never in our lives have an opportunity to do exactly what we want to do on somebody else's dime. Let's just enjoy this magnificent city of Berlin, Germany, and enjoy ourselves. So I put it to rest. I did during that year send out the three chapters I had to a friend I'd seen, the subject came up. She gave me some very good feedback. But it wasn't until about 3 years ago, three or four years ago, when I was having dinner with Greg Shaw in Seattle. We have lots of several students from Seattle and alums there. The subject came up. He was wanting to know more about the memoir. Do you have any chapters you can send me? I send them to him. He arranged for me to get an agent, and the rest is history.
Your path to leadership routed through music specifically, and within that, yeah, the cello. Can you tell me a little bit about the discipline and focus it takes to become exceptional at the cello, and how that is analogous to what you've been, your pathway to leadership?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I started cello rather late. I didn't start until I was 14. Up until that time, my primary musical outlet was singing. I started singing in the church when I was 6 years old. After I'd been playing the cello for about 8 months, a professor at Miami University, I grew up in Cincinnati, Miami University is 35 miles up the road, started teaching me. And you can read more about how that all happened in the book. But particularly, I want to mention that event, because it was critically important. I was kind of a natural born musician. I played very, very well. She was impressed at how well I could play after 8 months. But what she did is that she taught me how to become a thinking musician, how to execute what was in my mind through the instrument. Which may sound easy, but it's a rather complicated process, in the sense that sometimes what you think you are performing is not really coming out. And I'll stop here and just say the way that how that manifests itself in a leadership role is kind of being cognizant of the presentation of yourself. There's a book written by Irving Goffman called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. And a lot of times leaders are not aware of how they present themselves, how they show up to others, and therefore the impact of their behavior on others. They may think, oh, I'm really very persuasive, or I'm doing X, Y, or Z, when it's being perceived on the other side as very different. So because of my training as a musician, I don't take for granted how people receive whatever I'm saying or doing. So I readily try to get feedback of some sort, and I ask questions. So I don't assume because I say something as a leader that somebody, you know, if they just because they shake their head and say, yeah, I think that's a good idea, that doesn't necessarily mean that they really think it's a good idea. So you have to probe further. I also say, Mike, that in my career as a chamber musician in particular has been has played a role in developing my leadership style in the sense that if you think about the difference between a chamber music organization and an orchestra, the biggest difference is that in a chamber music organization, there's not a conductor making decisions for you. You have to make the decisions yourselves as a group, three or four, you know. And so that means there has to be collaboration. It's not the same as consensus, collaboration. Right. Because at the end of the day, someone has to make a decision, but everyone has had an opportunity to share their perspectives about that decision. So that's something else that is indicative of my leadership style. Another thing I've learned from music, it's not unrelated to the third lesson I was talking about there, and that is, you know, in music, you cannot be thin-skinned, particularly in a chamber music organization, because if you're going to, I played in the Klemperer Trio for almost 4 years, and I mean we're brutally honest with each other. That's flat. Or you played that too slowly.
Right.
Or we need to work on that. And you can't, you know, you can't shrink away from it or feel, you know, take it on personally. You have to execute. So I think that's fairly important. One of the things that people say about my leadership is that they appreciate the fact that that I'm open to taking criticism and that I act on it. So I think that's another thing that's important. Also, the listening skills that one owns as a musician are critically important, because I think being active listening is something which is missing in our society in general these days. That is sitting down with someone or several people and really hearing what they have to say, rather than focusing so much on how you're going to respond that you really don't hear what they have to say.
Last question then. I'm curious about your views on your type of leadership and how it relates to how polarized the country feels right now. And a lot of people think that the polarization, I mean, if you actually look at surveys, people's, you know, thoughts and feelings about, you know, people in different political beliefs or different political parties, it appears to be relatively true that people are feeling like a much greater threat from the other, the thing, the person that they don't agree with. Talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if you were to ask me, for whom this book is written, in general, I could give you some specific audiences, you know, young leaders, you know, young black professionals. But I would say in general, any American who's concerned about the political and cultural polarization of our country would, I think, glean some useful perspectives from this book. I am very much concerned about the fact that we have come to a place in the United States of America where because someone holds a different political perspective from you, or is a different religion or a different race, we no longer simply see that person as simply having an opposing or different view. we often, more often now, people vilify, you know, those individuals and don't really, are not open to even having a conversation, which I think is really problematic for the health of our democracy, because our democracy in the United States of America, I often like to say, is not a fully fledged adult. At best, our democracy is an emerging adult. And so that means we need to pay attention to its attention to sustaining it. Those views really represent the way that I have approached my leadership in three different higher education institutions, or I could say in every institution, but the three executive level positions I've had as provost at Miami University, as president at Wheaton College, and president at the University of Richmond. And that is to say, my assumption is that when our students come to our residential campuses, and these are all residential campuses, they come from all around the world, various races, backgrounds, economic statuses. I do not assume that they have any experiential base from which to know how to develop relationships across those differences. And so my assumption is that we have to help them gain those skills. We have to develop cultures of trustworthiness on our campuses so that our students can practice first, learn, and then practice skills so that they can have full-throated discussions and conversations about a broad variety of issues. I think if we can achieve that at a college or university, then we are going to better prepare them for the world they're going into, and they are going to be, in my estimation, better citizens and contribute in quality effectively to the health of our democracy.
That is Dr. Ronald Crutcher, president of University of Richmond. His new book, I Had No Idea You Were Black, Navigating Race on the Road to Leadership. Dr. Crutcher, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Surely. It's my pleasure.
He was such a pleasure to talk to. We actually ended up talking a bit longer than that, but just on musings about life out here in Seattle and where he's living now. Anyway, if you get a chance to read it again, the book title is I Had No Idea You Were Black, Navigating Race on the Road to Leadership. Coming up on Cairo Nights, we're going to have Stacy at the top of the hour, and we're going to talk a little bit about the San Diego Padres. The reason we're talking about them is they're in about the same size market, a little bit bigger market than Seattle, but they're doing a massive and fast reconstruction to make their team a contender. And, well, how does that make us look? Keep listening, and you'll find out right after the break. Of who was coming into the country and how they should be treated, processed and treated, or if they should be allowed to come in at all, really changed in the last 4 years. The Trump administration had not a closed borders policy, but definitely a very fine filter borders policy that was actually perceived, and I think that's not necessarily unfair, as being a little hostile, if not very hostile, to immigrants. And I don't know about you, but I found myself the other day sitting at a table, myself, my girlfriend, my buddy Vic was sitting there, and it occurred to me that all three of us were the children of immigrants. My mom is from originally from Nicaragua, and she grew up in Colón, which is the Caribbean seaport of the Panama Canal. My dad was stationed in the Army down there and met her in the early 1950s. And then they met down there, married, lived down there a little while, and then moved back up here to the States. But I spent a lot of time going back there, visiting relatives through the course of my life. And, you know, and the other two both had parents who, I think both of Vic's parents and one of Mary's were from other countries as well. And I guess maybe that's why I've always felt that the immigration in this country has always been one of its strong suits, not one of its weak suits. In Mary's case, the driver of her father's immigration, he was a Boeing engineer, was Boeing itself. They went overseas and recruited. He had just graduated, I think, near the top of, if not at the top of his class from University of Glasgow. He's an electrical engineer. And they met with him. They offered him a job. They got him a green card. They arranged for everything. And that's the way the United States set back aviation in Europe for a generation, because Boeing went over there and McDonnell Douglas and other companies and essentially did a brain drain. You know, they scooped up the best engineering talent and brought it over to the United States. And then there's, you know, all kinds of other, everyone has immigrant stories, from the immigrants who come because they're poor and looking for a better opportunity, the ones who are not poor and still looking for a better opportunity, and people who don't have, who always see the places with without a ceiling, like in the United States. Well, all of that changed in the Trump administration. And I think it was a mistake, because even within his own family, the former president's own family, are immigrants. In all of our families, generally speaking, are immigrants. And I'm not espousing, you know, the advocacy for illegal immigration. I am espousing a agreeable immigration plan that actually welcomes it, because the fact of the matter is, it's always been this great strength. Jeff Bezos, the child of immigrants, Elon Musk. I mean, we're talking about some of the most prominent entrepreneurs in this country aren't necessarily a multi-generational American. So what's happening now? Well, this is something you probably don't even listen to me exclusively about it, or don't even listen to anyone else on the radio exclusively about it. Read this up for yourself, because this is going to be one of the most interesting early developments when we're sorting through vaccinations and pandemic. I think the Biden administration is going to focus a lot on is economic recovery, and a portion of that is going to be his immigration plan. So let me tell you a little bit about it. So one of the websites I really enjoy reading is Vox. If you haven't, Vox does explanatory journalism. It's not partisan. It sort of tries to walk you through issues so you get a deeper understanding of it, rather than a lot of the he said, she said, they said back and forth bickering that happens in a lot of other journalism. And I like that stuff, too. Sometimes it's important to know the political ramifications. But early on, I just want to know, well, what does this policy mean? And then I can start making my own judgments about it. So this one says this. The centerpiece of the bill is an 8-year path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who arrived in the United States prior to January 2021. It also includes provisions that would address the underlying causes of migration, expand the number of available visas and green cards, invest in technology and infrastructure at the ports of entry at the border, and remove obstacles to asylum and shore up protection for immigrant workers. Absent from the bill are provisions that would promote the kind of border security and interior enforcement measures that the Republicans have long sought. For example, previous Republican proposals would have boosted funding for the construction of a border wall, make it a crime to be president of the United States without authorization, and require children to be indefinitely detained together with their parents while they face deportation proceedings. And the Trump administration, of course, created the kind of separation thing within that provision. This changes that. And the funny thing about this is this actually is fairly similar to what immigration was under George Bush, both Bush and his father. The immigration plans were not very different from that. The tightening you saw really did happen during the Trump administration. And that's not just immigrants coming from, say, across the border, which is the way I think a lot of people think of it. It was H-1B visas for tech engineers. It was people moving to the States from all kinds of places. And why do I think that this is a good idea? Well, one, there isn't. So here's one of the interesting things about it. And if you read The Economist, for example, very conservative economics based magazine out of London, and it argues that the United States is actually in a better position financially over the course of the next 20 years and 30 years than China is, for one key reason. We have enough children being born in this country to actually fund the older people, which is the way most economies work. Like the young people in the workforce are paying into a system that they're not drawing much from, and that is what's paying for Social Security and Medicare and all those sort of things. Well, China's in a real difficult situation because of the one-child policy, which lasted for a generation. They do not have the young people in the workforce and do not allow a lot of immigration. They don't have the young people in the workforce to actually move into those to fund the aging population, which is significant. And it's an aging population that did a lot of smoking. And so the concern is that it is going to be very difficult for the Chinese, for the young Chinese, to be able to pay for the aging and sickly Chinese that came before them. In our country, here's the funny thing. The Economist article pointed out the whole reason the United States is well positioned to have a young workforce when people say my age, which is 50s, or people in their 40s now, when all of us enter those retirement years where we're drawing more out of the system than we're putting into it, the whole reason is that third generation Americans are having their birth rate is relatively low. They're not having a lot of kids. The only people having kids and keeping the child birth rate up high, immigrants. And that is why we are going to be able to pay for people who are like me and like maybe like you if you're listening to this show. It is actually going to be a great strength of our economy, not a drain on the economy. And I think that a plan that actually allows people in, doesn't allow everyone in, allows people in and allows them to get toward a path where they can become citizens. I mean, I don't know very many. If you've ever been to a swearing in ceremony, I don't know many people who are more patriotic than new citizens in the United States. It really is. It's worth if you ever have a chance to attend, if you have a friend who's becoming a citizen and you want to go to their ceremony. It really is uplifting, and it reminds you why you're proud to be living in this country. And also, if you want, take the citizenship test. It's available online. Good luck with that. It's not that easy, and you actually have to do a fair bit of understanding, and I think sometimes they end up with much better understanding of the United States than native, than naturalized or born citizens here. Anyway, all this is to say, I am hopeful that this, and take a good read, because I don't have the time to sort of dissect it right now, but we'll be talking about it a lot in the future, because I do think this is going to be one of the more important things that the Biden administration is going to try to tackle, and it's going to be a difficult one, because obviously there's going to be a lot of opposition, and even in that opposition, maybe it will end up as being even a better package after that. Coming up on Cairo Nights, we have the random question robot right after the break. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. This is, again, that stretch of the show where the most important questions in life actually are never asked. But a bunch of questions we can't answer are. And right. It is the random question robot's job to add just a little bit of pain to our evenings so we can add a little bit of joy to yours. At least we hope. All right. Are we ready?
I think we're ready.
Fire it off.
Let's get it going. All right, Frank, this one seems very appropriate for you. Frank, who is your favorite cartoon character of all time?
What comes to my mind immediately is Snoopy, I guess, although I'm a big fan of Calvin and Hobbes. But I just really, I guess from my earliest days, thought Snoopy was the best, which that's such a boring answer, but...
I don't think so. Those are both pretty good, you know, classic cartoons, especially Calvin and Hobbes. Yeah, that's one of my absolute favorite. Mike, what about you?
It's a toss-up, and they're pretty different. It's either Daffy Duck or Lisa Simpson.
They're both great. I love Daffy.
I love Daffy's complete frustration with everything around him and constant anger, because it's exactly the way I feel in traffic. And Lisa, of course, because Lisa is the moral center of the Simpsons, and I think that she's wonderful.
That, those are both so great answers. I, thinking about this one's kind of hard for me, but... I think I would have to go with one of a more recent show. Have you guys ever seen the show F is for Family?
No.
I'm not.
It is a cartoon that's written by the comedian Bill Burr.
And oh, well, if it's a Bill Burr thing, then I'm sure I would like it.
It's absolutely fabulous.
Where is it?
It's on Netflix. It's about to go into its fourth season, I believe. But it is absolutely great. The main character is a dad named Frank Murphy, who's a dad during the 1970s. He's a Vietnam vet.
This is a cartoon.
It's a cartoon, yeah. And it's just about this family growing up, and it's just about this guy who just has an amazingly large temper trying to just be a dad and grow up in good old suburbia in the 1970s. 70s, and it's got some awesome characters, so I really think that that's a great one.
That's a great choice.
All right, so let's see what else we got here. Well, this only leaves me, so if you could be any animal, what would you be? This is a very tough one, because I can't decide whether I want to choose to be an active animal or be a completely lazy animal. Whether I want to be a sloth or, you know, have something that actually, you know, has some weight to it. But I think if I had to choose an animal, I think I'd be a hyena. I think hyenas are absolutely fascinating animals. They very aggressive. They're huge. They're scary looking. But they're also kind of just kind of the jokesters of the jungle, I guess, or the Sahara, wherever they might be. I don't know. I'm not an expert, but I think hyenas are cool, so I'd probably choose a hyena. What do you think, Frank?
I love otters, and I used to want to be a sea otter, but I changed that. So if I were going to pick, I would pick river otter. I just find them enormous. They seem like they're having a great time all the time. Now, I know they're animals, right? And so they're trying to get food most of the time, but I watch them play, and I just think, man, that is the life. They just seem to have a good one.
True. Mike?
You know, that's an interesting one. Otters, obviously, are you know, always at the top, should be at the top of almost everyone's list, because they do seem like they have got it figured out.
Yep.
But I'm going to go with something different. I would actually like, I mean, it kind of depends on which specific subset, but I think I'd go with whale. And I think I'd go maybe with sperm whale, just because they dive at times like over a mile deep the ocean, going after giant squid. And there's so much of the planet that you can see that I haven't seen at this point, and that I would like to be able to see. And the only way you can do it is if you're built for it, and they are built for it. They're also not aggressively whaled everywhere, so
yeah,
I feel like you'd have a good long life potentially, and you'd get to see all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't be able to see otherwise.
That's cool. A great answer. That well, great. It looks like the robot's done with us again tonight, boys. Okay.
Well, that's all right. All right, folks, thanks again for joining us with the Random Question Robot. We are coming back in just a few minutes. Stacy's coming in, and we are not, well, yeah, well, actually, we are going to talk more sports tonight, I think. We're going to talk a little bit about, a mid-market team that is actually doing a lot to rebuild. And unfortunately, we're not talking about the Mariners right after the break.